It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 58 for Friday the 13th of January, 2012. The Wired.co.uk tree is ready to bloom with podcast fruit for another year, and on the show this week, we'll peel the first and take a juicy great bite. It's gadget heaven over at the Consumer Electronics Show, and we'll summarise the new tech we'd most like to smuggle through customs on the way back home. Plus, it's bad news for music service Grooveshark as it swims into the clutches of every single major music label lawyer, and they're hungry for shark meat. And Duncan is incredulous as a company tries to launch an interstellar dating service. No. All that and more coming up. Ahoy, it's Nate Langston here. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk, and joining me is news editor Duncan Gear.
Hello, I'm slightly hoarse today.
I wish you were a horse.
And that sultry voice over there is, of course, associate editor Olivia _ Solon.
Hello.
We're back for another year.
It's lovely to be here.
It is. I'm sorry to people for missing last week's show, but it was Duncan's fault.
Not strictly speaking.
It wasn't my fault at all.
Duncan took a holiday the very same week that I was ill.
You chose to get ill, mate.
It's very true. No, we're very sorry.
Basically, it wasn't Liv's fault, is what we've established here.
That's the bottom line. Liv is innocent.
Exactly.
But we are back, and we have got a pretty cool show lined up. We're also going to talk later about Stephen Hawking, who was, well, he celebrated his 70th birthday this week, and we've got a very interesting feature from his birthday party coming up in the second half of the show. But first, CES. The Celebrity Electronics Showcase.
As it's almost pretty much called now.
It might as well be. CES is a massive tech show that goes on in Las Vegas every January. And every year it seems to get more and more celebrities showing up to pimp stuff for the companies that pay them extra cash.
Who have we had this year?
Oh, we've had everyone.
Will Smith.
Yeah, Will Smith. Justin Baubles was there. And
Kelly Clarkson.
Lil Cool J.
I think it was 50 Cent was there.
Was he there?
Yep.
Was he one, because you're on Twitter being a real douche, showing all his cash that he'd accumulated?
That sounds like the kind of thing he might do.
Yeah.
Slappable. But we're not here to focus on celebrities, but we are going to talk a little bit about some of the tech that's been shown off this year, just to give you a highlight. There have been a few trends that we've spotted. The first is, unpredictably, tablet computers are pretty much everywhere.
Pretty much.
But in a good way. We've seen some really high-powered stuff coming out to sort of compete with the iPad, I guess, this year. Some multi-core processors inside some tablets and massive screens and...
Yeah, you're running out of things to
really
say.
Really exciting.
The problem is that all of these, they're trying to compete with the iPad in terms of technology, and the whole reason the iPad's been successful isn't because of its technology, it's because of its user experience.
Yeah.
And while all these kind of manufacturers are slapping their own ugly skins on default Android, that's not going to improve. So I'm not predicting great things for Android tablets this year again.
But the difference this year is that we actually have a fully fledged tablet version of Android, which we sort of did last year, but no one really used it because it wasn't enough time. Whereas this year, we've got tablet Android and we've got the hardware to make it awesome.
Yeah.
So I kind of think that this is going to be still probably the year of the iPad, but the year it has the hottest competition.
I think the real... What will settle the debate once and for all is how many developers get on board and start making large screen versions of their phone Android apps. Because in the phone ecosystem, Android is very, very competitive with iPhone. Most big popular iPhone apps are available on Android, but the same isn't true for the iPad.
Skinny TVs have also been a hot trend this year, and we've seen a couple from Sony and LG, not Sony, Samsung, I think, and LG, who've shown off 55-inch OLED television screens. And these are basically the same types of screens that you see in a lot of phones. You know, those kind of super bright colors on the, like Samsung phones use OLED or AMOLED. And these are stupidly thin televisions, like a few millimeters thick.
But they can still deliver amazing colors and really, really dark blacks and everything.
Yeah.
They're gorgeous to look at, but they're very, very expensive to produce in such big sizes.
Liv, have you seen any of these?
I have, and they are cool, but I've never looked at my TV, which is a flat screen, and thought, man, I really wish that was much flatter. Thinner. Like, yeah, it's not a big problem for you. I can see if you're super rich, it's lovely, and they look beautiful, and they do all sorts of demonstrations with various things held up against it to show how thin they are. But but yeah, I'm not going to be forking out for one anytime soon.
Well, so for you, it's basically a bit like 3D. It's going to happen, and you're just not that bothered.
It's going to happen. If it gets really cheap, then I might upgrade, but not at the moment.
I think more likely what's going to happen is that the TV is going to get cheaper. They're going to come on the market, and when you are ready to buy a new telly, these are the kind that you're going to be buying, because they're starting to look like actual products that are going to hit the market. Sony had some OLED TVs. Remember, about 3 years ago, they showed off this like little tiny 11-inch OLED TV that was absolutely beautiful. Everyone was talking about it, but it cost something like £2,000 and was basically only the right size if you wanted to have one in the toilet, which not many people did. And they've actually cancelled that. They're not even going to be making them. And Samsung of LG and LG have stepped up to make these huge ones. So we shall see. 3D was predicted to be a massive thing every year. But this year,
it's finally starting to sort of dissipate as a force for excitement within consumer electronics.
I just really hope finally that these manufacturers have kind of come to the realization that nobody gives an S about 3D. Nobody cares. Like in the cinema, fair enough, people do for some reason want to go and see 3D films, but no one seems to give a damn about buying them for the home. But one of the problems has been obviously the fact that you have to wear stupid glasses and look like a bit of an arse. And so some of the TVs with 3D that we've seen at CES this year have not needed glasses. We've seen a prototype, I think, from Toshiba that uses a camera in the front of the screen to monitor where your face is. And as long as you're looking at the right part of the screen, which the camera helps you position yourself for, then you can watch this 3D image without having glasses on.
They had that at IFA as well.
But we're starting to see them from more manufacturers now, and this looks like the next step that manufacturers are trying to take to get 3D down our throats without us choking with hate.
Still not going to buy one.
No,
me neither, but bless them for trying. And the other thing that we wanted to flag was actually another television-based thing, but this is 4K. And this is a new resolution of image that's actually slightly higher than the 1080p that you may or may not have in your home.
So explain very quickly what 1080p is. Why is it 1080p?
1080p, it's basically 1080 horizontal lines on an image. And that's basically the resolution that Blu-ray uses, or that you will see on the super big YouTube videos, or that it's actually 1080i that like Sky will broadcast for their HD, for example.
And what's 4K?
It's basically just over double that resolution. But rather than just rounding up trends, we wanted to pick out a thing that we were all interested in to highlight. Liv, I'm going to start with you because you haven't said any words for a minute.
I haven't. It's about time I do.
What is your highlight from CES?
Well, as you probably know, I'm about as excited about CES as I am about going into a massive Dixons or PC world. Does Dixons even exist anymore?
No.
No.
I think it does online.
But some of the cool things that came out, I saw a Victorinox Swiss Army knife that had a terabyte USB drive on it. Did it?
Yes, that's deliciously pointless.
Yeah, but just I thought that was quite cool. You know, you've got your knife, you've got your file, you've got your pair of scissors, and thank God you've got that terabyte.
Yeah, the good thing is, though, is that you can take, I think, the blade part out.
Yeah.
So you can take that terabyte of storage onto a plane.
Yeah.
I've heard, and correct me if I'm wrong, planes don't like knives on them.
No.
So it's good that you can do this.
It's a bit strange, though, because you think that if you're out in the wilds where you might need all the other tools, you're not probably going to have that much access to...
I think it's a bit of a status symbol type thing. Hey, look at my...
Look at my knife.
Look at my thumb drive. I've got a terabyte on it. It's going to cost $2,000, though, I think, so not many people are going to be wielding these around.
No. And the other thing that I liked was the fact that Dish, a satellite video provider, took a baby kangaroo onto stage, which was better than any of the celebrities put together.
Must have been terrifying for the
poor
thing.
Yeah, it would have been terrifying.
He didn't look very happy being cuddled, I have to say.
I think they drugged him.
That sounds like slander.
Yeah.
Duncan, what did you pick?
I've kind of got two picks. Can I have two picks? They've had two picks.
Yeah, you can have one. I hope one of them is a marsupial.
Neither of them is a marsupial, I'm afraid. The first is the Fuji X-Pro1, which is a really tasty-looking interchangeable lens camera. It looks pretty similar to a Leica camera, but it's going to come at a fraction of the price and with some really, really nice lenses.
Yeah, the Leicas are pretty amazing cameras, but they are expensive. I played with one where the body alone was worth about $5,000, and I think the lens was worth about $4,500 to $5,000. They're posh toys. They're amazing cameras, though. They are absolutely brilliant. They don't work in the same way as a DSLR. You kind of put sort of a fixed focal length lens on the front, and you have to sort of move yourself close to the object to you know, to zoom, if you like. Zoom with your feet. But yeah, this looks like an amazing camera, the Fujifilm.
Definitely. And my other choice was, there's been an awful lot of laptops coming out of CES, and almost all of them are Ultrabooks, which is this new thing that the laptop industry has dreamed up that they're getting excited about. And they're all not very interesting. They're all basically clones of the MacBook Air, i.e. thin, light, and powerful. Mm. But one of them did catch my eye. The Dell XPS 13 looks really, really tasty. I want to get my hands on one of them as soon as I can and have a play around with it because it looks lovely.
Yeah, Dell's going to have to send one of those in pretty damn soon.
How much is it going to be?
Around $1,000, I think,
okay, so
which will probably translate to about £1,000 over here. But I think there'll be sort of several different specs that you can configure it from. It'll be, you know, as with most PCs, you get very, very similar features as the Apple thing, but at about 2/3 of the price.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
What about you, Nate? What's your fave?
Well, my fave has to be the Sony Xperia S, which is basically a super tricked out Android smartphone, and it's actually the first in over a decade from Sony that isn't a Sony Ericsson, because Sony bought out Ericsson's share in their mobile phone business, and so now the phones are just Sony's, and this is the first one. And it's basically, if you think of all the top specs you can get in a phone at the moment, it has them, and it looks pretty gorgeous. We did a hands-on and it looks pretty slick.
And you described it as a nine-legged baby. Discuss.
Strictly speaking, I didn't. I wrote a piece on the site about it, but I said it's kind of like Sony wanted to cram everything into this thing and make it win the race, and I sort of likened that to them trying to give birth to a super fast, fit, able baby with nine legs. And I wasn't sure that a baby with nine legs was a good baby, even if it was really fast. Anyway, to be honest, I don't know what happened that day. I was pretty out of it. So go and read it if you want to laugh. But yeah, that's coming out in March, and it's got all the usual specs. 1.5 gigahertz dual core processor, super high res screen, and it runs PlayStation games from the PlayStation store. So that's pretty cool.
Looking forward to it.
Yes, so that rounds up our CES coverage, I guess. If you go to wire.co.uk and search for CES 2012, then you'll find all of our coverage from the show. We've picked out a lot of highlights, so go and have a look if you want to see some more. Apologies for that voice. Let's move on. Duncan, what the frack is fracking, and why has it been Alfla News this week?
Alfla News.
I don't know what that is. Why has it been in the news, Duncan? What's fracking?
Fracking is a process where people trying to get natural gas out of the ground, methane gas, will inject fluids at very, very high pressures into chambers about between a mile and 2 miles below the ground to try and fracture them, releasing the methane contained within.
And they capture that methane, and I know that some people have said that this causes earthquakes.
Yes, it has a very, very bad reputation among kind of the environmental movement. It's been blamed for widespread earthquakes, but it also has been blamed for contaminating groundwater, methane getting into groundwater. There was a film out last year in the States called Gasland, which showed people turning on their taps in some areas and then lighting their tap water on fire. It's you know, quite incendiary stuff, no pun intended.
But the British Geological Survey has come out actually in favour of this process.
Well, I think possibly in favour is a bit strong, but they've said that it's actually, and I quote, pretty safe. They say that the distance between where the fracking takes place, more than a mile below the ground, and where the groundwater is, which is typically 40 to 50 metres, is so great that there's almost no chance of the methane making its way up to our groundwater reserves. And the methane that we see kind of in groundwater is as a result of, it naturally occurs. And the problem is, we don't actually know how much methane naturally occurs in groundwater. Mm-hmm. So the next step that they've proposed, and which we're doing at the moment, is that we sort of study existing groundwater reservoirs far away from fracking areas to try and work out what this baseline level of natural methane in groundwater is, and then we can see if fracking increases that or not.
And once we do that, we'll know for sure whether all the people who are complaining are actually wrong.
Yes,
or if
much.
They're right,
or if they're right, yeah. I mean, it's basically good news in either direction, because we find out more about this process, which is very controversial.
Grooveshark is our next topic, and it's bad news bears for Grooveshark, the music service. Pull us to be explaining more, please.
Yes, it is bad news. Now, Grooveshark is a music streaming service, for those who don't know. It has 35 million members, and members can upload their own tracks to a central music library.
It's a bit like YouTube for music.
A little bit like YouTube for music. And, you know, in the same way, they get a lot of kind of takedown orders, and they have to comply with those. But anyway, that's not the point. The point is that Grooveshark is now being sued by EMI, and that would probably be okay if Grooveshark wasn't already being sued by Universal, Sony and Warner for not paying royalties.
So all four major record labels have empty dinner plates and they want shark meat on them.
Exactly. And EMI was actually the only company with which Grooveshark had a licensing deal, but it's now said that they haven't made a single payment and they're going for the cash.
So what does Grooveshark say about all of this?
Grooveshark maintains that it's a contract dispute and that it will be resolved. However, all of the record labels don't seem to think so. And the kind of major problem for Grooveshark is a whole load of emails that Universal uncovered, which seem to show employees of Grooveshark led the effort to post more than 113,000 pirated songs. So they were actively encouraging piracy, and it's documented in all these emails. And Universal is looking for maximum damages of $150,000 per song, which could potentially total, in their case, a ridiculous $17.1 billion.
Well, that's amazing. It kind of reminds me of like the other year, I think it was, in an anti-piracy case where the major labels were seeking total damages greater than the GDP of the planet Earth.
It's just
insane.
Well, the thing is, just to throw my insight rod into this debate and fish out some analysis, I don't think they actually want the money. I think really what we're doing here is trying to kill the Grooveshark.
Yeah, and I suspect that the burden of all these court cases probably will kill Grooveshark.
Yeah. But what's interesting is they're starting more of them on their own. They've actually sued Universal right back because what they did is they put up a video on YouTube of a load of stars sort of singing a song supporting what they're doing, and Universal used its kind of quite close relationship with YouTube to take that down.
Yeah.
Grooveshark claims illegally, and so they are suing them for misusing the takedown process on YouTube to affect their reputation. So that the outcome of that could be very, very interesting, especially because YouTube has weighed in and said that Universal did misuse the process.
So how do they let it happen then?
If you're registered as a content provider on YouTube,
you can get any video.
You can get anything.
It's automated. I mean, I've actually been on the computer where this has been done. You go to any video on YouTube, click this violates it, and that video, regardless of who has published it,
has gone.
Mm. Yeah. And if you then go to that video, it says this has been taken down by such and such because of copyright violations. It's really, it's like wielding a huge power hammer. It's very satisfying, but it's actually very worrying if you're on the side of, you know, content producers who are getting their content removed without recourse,
not permission. Yeah, recourse. Mm. I guess.
Well, staying on the topic of media, Netflix launched in the UK. Netflix is pretty much, I think, the biggest movie streaming service in the world, and has been in the US for a long time. And in fact, at peak times, it's estimated that Netflix in the US accounts for 30% of all internet traffic in the whole of the country. So a third of the bandwidth in the US at peak times is being used by Netflix. That's a huge figure.
It's enormous.
And they've now launched in the UK to offer streaming movies and TV shows, although no DVDs, which I find very interesting, since Netflix was basically built off the back of DVD rentals. So
how does it work?
Well, it works. They have a one flat fee. You sign up and you can stream movies and TV shows to your PC, your Mac, your Xbox, pretty much every media device that has an internet connection seems to be supported by Netflix. But what's quite cool is that when I met up with their CEO, Reed Hastings, earlier this week, I was asking him about, you know, are you competing with Love Film and can these two companies compete, you know, peacefully? And he seemed to think that really both of these companies, Netflix and Love Film, are really competing with Sky Movies and Sky Atlantic, which has kind of had this streaming movie market without competition for a long time, which I found to be very, very interesting. And the more you think about it, Love Film does do streaming movies and TV stuff, but they also do Blu-ray rentals and DVD rentals and game rentals and things like that. So in a way, you could sort of have both services, you know, with very little crossover.
But you've tried the service, right? What's it like?
Yeah, it's a movie streaming service. I mean, it's good. They have a nice interface. The catalogue is still blossoming, so it's
blossoming is a kind way of putting it.
Yeah, it's
very, very weak.
It's a bit of an acorn at the moment, but they've got quite a lot of cool stuff. But it will grow. If you stream it on an Xbox or a PS3, you get like 1080p streaming, and it's got surround sound. So
do
it's you? Yeah, it's really good.
For me, the biggest problem with it and Love Film and all of these you know services is that the catalogue isn't there. Mm. You know, I'll log on and I'll say, oh, I want to watch this, and then I'll search for it, and it's like, oh, it's not there. Okay, I'll try this. Oh, that's not there. Oh, but there is this that they've, you know, put up next to it. Yeah, you know, I guess I could watch that. But you find something that you will watch, but it's not what you wanted to watch in the first place.
I asked Reed Hastings about that, and he was likening Netflix to more like a TV channel that has a limited supply, but on a subscription where you can have as much as you want, versus iTunes, which is kind of, you know, you pay a rental fee for a couple of quid, but they've got this vast back catalogue because it's ad hoc. And, I mean, he admitted that iTunes library was absolutely, you know, gargantuan in terms of the amount of content they've got on and bigger than theirs, but he sees those as two completely different services, kind of like, you know, Blockbuster of old versus, you know, just TV that's streaming certain films. But
for the $5.99, do you get unlimited movies? You don't have to pay every time you...
No, it's unlimited.
That's good.
As many devices. So, yeah, it's pretty cool. If you've tried it, let us know what you think. podcast@wired.co.uk. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to get domainy.
Wired magazine, now available to our print subscribers at no extra cost. For more information or to subscribe to the paper and iPad editions for just £2 per issue, go to wired.co.uk/iPad.
Olivia._Solon. That's the domain that could be in existence in not too many years' time.
It could be.
Couldn't it live?
It could be.
Explain why that's not mad.
That is not mad because from this week you can apply for your own top level domain, which, if you don't know what that is, it's the thing after the final dot in a URL. So .com, .co.uk, .biz. But now you can apply for any word after the dot. So it could be a brand, it could be .pepsi, it could be .live, it could be .duncan and .nate. However, you do need quite a little bit of cash.
How much cash?
Yeah, tell us.
$185,000 just to apply.
Say what, girlfriend?
And if
that's
successful, it's a further $25,000 per year for every domain that you own.
That's crazy. So who is this aimed at? Who can afford that? I suppose Pepsi. And
I guess, yeah, people. The big kind of target is brands. You know, the kind of argument is that this will help kind of market for marketing purposes and general kind of, they say it might be SEO friendly, but there's no evidence to support that at this stage.
But that's the point, isn't it? I mean, how many people actually are typing in these domains anyway? I mean, surely you're just Googling Olivia Solon.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, how important is the URL? As you say, you just Google. And there's a huge opposition in the US from people like the Association of National Advertisers, which represents so many big brands like Procter & Gamble and Coca-Cola. So those brands aren't necessarily going to be signing up. But elsewhere in Europe and in Asia, there's been a bit more of a positive response because these are brands that might not necessarily own the .com of their brand name. It might be another one that exists in the US that has that.
So what's their objection to it? Is it just that they've got sour grapes that they didn't get there first?
I don't think it's that they didn't get there first. They see it as an unnecessary expense. And I think in the US where .com is king, and if you've already got the .com, there isn't really a need for it, I don't think. It might be helpful for, as you say, some marketing purposes, but it's not necessary. I think they'll be annoyed that when a competitor, a small company in Asia with the same name, buys the domain and now has .apple or .sun, that's where the irritation is going to come, and they're going to feel forced to pay for it in order to defend that brand name.
All right, so for the man in the street and for everyone listening, I mean, how does this benefit us? How do these names actually change the web for the better?
Well, that's a very good point. There's a couple of arguments that I've been given. I spoke to a couple of companies who are helping process some of these applications, and they argue that for financial companies and companies where there's a lot of fraud, these new domains could help prove that a site isn't fraudulent, because anyone who's been able to fork out $185,000 is kind of more than likely to be the true owner of that brand. So for banks specifically, you'd also be able to maybe have a personalized URL where you went to oliviasolon.hsbc. I don't know if they're applying, but possibly.
I guess the bottom line here is that the benefits are pretty much going to be only to massive corporations to prove their authenticity, and ICANN is going to milk a whole lot of money out of these huge companies just so they can essentially protect their trademarks.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that seems like a good deal for everyone except people who are just browsing the web and have to remember all this stuff.
Exactly. But companies have until the 12th of April to submit their $185,000 application. And then after that, the ICANN will release a list of all the companies that have applied 2 weeks later. And then it won't be until 2013 until we see any of these domains.
Wow. Well, in other wows, I could not help but say wow to our sort of last news story of the day. Interstellar dating.
Yeah, I got an email this morning. It was a press release. I'm not going to name who it was from.
No, please
you
don't.
You can go to our website and find out if you really want to. It announced that it was launching the world's first intergalactic dating app.
So I can go and get jiggy with an alien.
That's basically the idea, yeah. What they've done is they've built an app where you can download it onto your smartphone and then you can make contact with humans, and I'm quoting by this, make contact with the aliens by a form of, quote, space-age email or a futuristic type of text message.
My bullshit detector is going off heavily at this point. There are so many things wrong with this. I don't know where to begin.
Let me give you some more things that are wrong with this.
Okay. They
I'm going to just read out little chunks of the press release here because it was just phenomenal. A two-way GPS satellite armed with NASA-inspired technology is going to transfer the communication between Earth and the far-flung corners of our galaxy almost instantly using radio waves.
That's impressive. Our galaxy is like 100,000 light years across. That's going to take a long time to get a reply, even at the speed of light.
Especially using a GPS satellite to do it.
Big claims.
Which was
powerful
hilarious.
Claims.
But also, a spokesman, apparently quoted in the press release, said that the app would theoretically be available for life forms on planets further away from Earth, including Europa and Enceladus. Those aren't planets,
they're moons.
They're
moons.
And there's not going to be aliens there. I mean, there might be life, but not aliens that you're actually going to want to flirt with.
Yeah. This is the most bizarre thing I ever heard. But fortunately, you went all enzyme on this and broke it down on the website.
Yeah, I went into quite some detail about this. It really, really upset me. So
yeah.
I managed to... I went through it.
The thing is, to be fair, this is a PR stunt to get this company named, which is why we haven't named them and haven't actually named them on the website at all. But it's just, I hate stuff like this. It really bugs me.
But what I don't understand, and we won't name the company, but what is the company, is it an apps developing company?
It's a dating service.
They're a dating site.
A dating site.
Mm.
If you go to wired.co.uk and search for something like interstellar dating or...
I think if you search worst press release, you will also find
it. That will bring it up too. So go and check it out.
But on that note, we're going to bring Katie in because it's Stephen Hawking's 70th birthday this week. And she went up to essentially his birthday party and met a whole bunch of people.
I hope they sung happy birthday to him. Do you think they did?
But he wasn't there.
Sadly, he wasn't
there.
Yeah,
but they should still have sung happy birthday to him.
But we will discuss all this in our feature. Katie, welcome to our trinket cupboard.
Thank you very much.
How the devil are you in your post-Christmas joining us ways?
I'm absolutely wonderful, and it is great to be back.
Good. Well, I know that one of the first things you did is travel up to Cambridge to celebrate Stephen Hawking's 70th birthday.
I did indeed. It was a fantastic conference, one-day conference called The State of the Universe. And the University of Cambridge had brought experts from all over the world together to celebrate the professor's 70th birthday.
And you were mingling with these people and dragged them into a corner, as you do so well and have done so often, and to ask them kind of all the same questions. So who have you been speaking to for us?
Well, I spoke to three of the speakers. I would have loved to have spoken to Professor Hawking, but unfortunately he wasn't there. So I managed to corner three of the other people who talked to them about Professor Hawking and his achievements.
Okay, cool. Well, who's up first?
First up was Professor Saul Perlmutter, who was actually the Nobel laureate in physics in 2011. So an amazing man himself and also a very, very close friend of Professor Hawking.
And the question you ask him?
What is Professor Hawkins' top achievement?
I mean, actually, what I would say is that there are so many, many people where you can identify a single thing as being, what somebody contributed. And what makes, I think, Stephen Hawking unusual is that it wasn't just one thing, but it was opening up a whole style of thinking about a number of very key topics that relate to these very fundamental physical approaches to how you interpret what's going on in cosmology and in these extreme black hole environments. And, the fact that those tie together in some way, the way you interpret the behavior of black hole could end up having something to do with how we interpret the whole universe as well, which is, these are all surprising. And the fact that you can ask these questions in these extreme environments and come up with some rigorous physics that can describe them at all is amazing. And I think Stephen really opened up a few of these areas to that kind of analysis.
So who else did you speak to?
Well, in the interval, I managed to get hold of the Astronomer Royal, Lord Rees of Ludlow. His talk was absolutely incredible because he basically gave a sense of how little we really know. And he compared cosmologists to plankton in a vase. So they're aware of their immediate surroundings, but there is so much that they might not know about. Anyway, I put the same question to him. What is Professor Hawking's top achievement?
Well, I think he's unique because of a combination of three things. First, his contributions to the science of cosmology and relativity. Secondly, what he's done for public outreach through his books and his TV programs, etc. But thirdly, of course, for the inspiration he's provided by Just Keeping Going.
So the next person you spoke to, I think, was Professor Kip Thorne.
That's right. And he was really, really interesting to talk to, not only because he's a world black hole expert, but he's also been friends with Professor Hawking for 46 years. So he admires him on a professional level and is obviously a very close friend as well. And so here's what he had to say.
I think for me, the greatest achievements are in the areas in which I work, which was to be the dominant person, the lead person, in teaching us about the nature of black holes, both big astrophysical-sized black holes governed by general relativity and tiny black holes governed by the combination of relativity and quantum physics. He set the directions for research in this area and for the research that has gone on in this area for the last several decades.
And last up is Professor Sir Leszek Borisowicz. I hope I've got his name right. He's the Vice Chancellor of the University of Cambridge, so was obviously instrumental in organising the event, but also has an opinion on the achievements of the Professor because they're both at the University of Cambridge.
Stephen's greatest achievement from my perspective is Stephen being Stephen. It's not just about his fantastic scientific work and his discoveries. Those make him an outstanding world scientist in his own right. It's about the fact, the spirit of hope that he brings to thousands of people who may not even understand what the science is that he's doing, but he's been himself, and he's been able to achieve in the face of adversity something that all of us would aspire to. But he's done that, and he's a visible symbol of hope for so many people over and above his scientific contribution, which is outstanding in its own way.
And as your role as Vice-Chancellor at the University of Cambridge, what impact does he have on the students here?
Well, he has a huge impact because the important thing in a university is the sense of mentorship, that the student and the staff enter into a working relationship together. And when you have an individual who's admirable as a person, as well as a world-renowned scientist in his own field, is an important symbol, but also an important way of interacting and showing students that actually what you can do is if you apply thought to the future and to important fundamental questions, we can make enormous progress. Sometimes we feel that very often we look for just the practical solution to problems of today. What Stephen exemplifies is that in a university such as Cambridge, we can also go into the very fundamental issues that ask the questions of what we are, where we've come from. And those are exciting areas for any academic to actually engage in. But it also shows that by tackling those problems, we can begin to find some of the solutions to the problems of today. And I think he's an inspiration to the students and to the university as a whole.
So there were all your interviews. It sounds like you had an amazing time.
Oh, it was absolutely incredible.
How come Stephen Hawking wasn't actually there?
He'd been sick, unfortunately, and he hadn't been at any events that week. And I know that there was a dinner that evening. There were all sorts of celebrities turning up in black tie, and Stephen Hawking wasn't going to be at that either.
Oh, such a shame. Well, happy birthday, Stephen Hawking, and get well soon. I actually had the pleasure of meeting him once about a year or so ago.
See, I'm incredibly jealous because it is definitely one of my ambitions in life. So when he wasn't there, then I was quite sad.
Well, you've written some pieces, I believe, that are on the site now.
Yep, I've written up all four of the talks, including Stephen Hawking's, because obviously the talk was given in his absence.
Yep. The advantage of having pre-recorded capabilities, I guess.
Indeed. So if you want to find out anything else about what those amazing men of physics had to say, then do check out those stories.
Fantastic. Thanks for joining us, Katie.
Thank you very much.
Katie Scott there. And we've got a few features, actually, from Stephen Hawking's birthday on the website. We have a number of things that Katie has written. And we also have a feature from one of our feature contributors, Gordon Kelly, who wrote about Intel. And Intel actually works on all the technology that actually helps keep Professor Hawking communicating. And we've got a great feature going into some detail about how they're developing new technology to help combat the fact that, sadly, Stephen Hawking's condition is deteriorating and making it much harder for his computer to actually help him talk. So we've got a great feature. If you search for Stephen Hawking on wired.co.uk, you'll find this feature. It's, to be honest, I speak without bias, it is fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, everything on wired.co.uk is wonderful, but this is particularly wonderful, and you should really read it.
Yeah. But on that note, we're going to end the show, and we're going to ask, who shall I ask? Eeny, meeny, miny, Liv. How do people get in touch with their feedback?
Well, they can catch us on Twitter. We're on @WiredUK. Or you can follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/WiredUK and click that like button.
And we have an email, which is podcast@wired.co.uk. There you go. That's how we do it in Wired style. And on that quite melodic note, we will see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I'll just make something up, I don't know. I can't think of one for this. That you can't connect gas to sharks is a simple fact of nature.